Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This man is your land. This man is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this man was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 369, recorded on Tuesday, April 27th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. Well, this episode, we're going to be talking about forest products. Now, you might not think of timber as something ripe for advanced technological research, but the Second Industrial Revolution marked a partial shift in the way timber was used in the United States. While Eastern North American timber harvests for centuries had provided Europeans and then Americans with crude fuel, cleared farmland, shipbuilding materials, and resources for artisanal furniture makers, the Second Industrial Revolution included a bit of a gear shift into highly manufactured, mass-produced forest products like wood pulp paper, which we've talked about on previous episodes, or things that we'll be talking about today, such as prefabricated homes or plywood, also known as, quote, engineered wood. So let's start by talking a little bit about the Forest Products Laboratory, although that's a bit later in the narrative. It's going to help us understand sort of the trajectory of how things were going and where things went. So while some innovation in this field of timber harvesting and usage came from the private sector, which we will definitely be talking about later on today's episode, as was also frequently the case, the U.S. government also provided a boost. You're probably very familiar with the U.S. government's role in publicly funding research and development for the benefit of the private sector in fields such as defense, biotech, information technology, and so on. But what you might not know is that the U.S. Forest Service has been running a research and development agency for over a century to benefit the timber industry. Now, I'm going to quote here from the website of the Forest Service Forest Products Laboratory. At the turn of the 19th century, logging had proceeded across much of the eastern United States, and demands for wood products were rising rapidly. In 1910, the Forest Products Laboratory, or FPL, was established in Madison, Wisconsin, to find ways to conserve scarce timber resources. Since then, our mission has been to use our nation's wood resources wisely and efficiently, while at the same time keeping our forests healthy. Our research began with preserving railroad ties, and now we are venturing into nanotechnology and finding ways that our research can contribute to mitigating the impacts of climate change. The FPL research staff has the experience and expertise needed to make us world-renowned among forest products research organizations and an unbiased source of information. FPL researchers have longevity, with an average of 20 years of experience in their related fields. The range of our wood research spans from fiber and chemical science to composites. We take pride in knowing that our research touches the American public's daily life, whether it's putting a self-adhesive, environmentally friendly stamp on an envelope, or walking on a hardwood floor. FPL has in some way contributed to making those products and innovations. Which I would not have guessed about the self-adhesive stamps, but that's an interesting point, and it's one of the cool reasons that we wanted to talk about this today. So a few other facts. As I said, located in Madison, Wisconsin since 1910, it's the nation's only federally funded wood utilization research laboratory. They have 60 research scientists, and they are primarily or partly responsible for many of today's wood-based technologies, including wood preservatives, glue lamb beams, oriented strand board, and fiber-based packaging. Some early research highlights mentioned on their website include reducing timber demand for railroad ties by 75% through preservatives research, increased average lumber yield per log from 25% to 60%, wood frame technology used in over 90% of our nation's homes, and designed and constructed the nation's first prefabricated home. Although, I think you could probably dispute that last one, as we'll talk about, just given the timing of that. During World War I, the laboratory performed experiments on wood for airplane construction as well as research into box and packaging materials and charcoal to be used in gas masks. During World War II, constant wood utilization projects were performed on the wood and lumber used for every aspect of the war effort. So that's some interesting history on the Forest Products Laboratory of the U.S. Forest Service, but it also gives you an insight into sort of what concepts we're talking about, especially in the later period, in terms of kind of engineering and technologizing and innovating on the use of forest products, or put it more bluntly, just wood and wood products. As I said, in this period from the Second Industrial Revolution after the Civil War on through this, you know, 1910 and so forth when they're establishing this laboratory, and then onward into the mid-century, we're really talking about this shift away from really kind of crude uses of timber and sort of very artisanal uses, and more toward this highly manufactured, mass-produced usages. Now, one of the most highly manufactured and mass-produced types of wood products you can talk about is obviously plywood. So, Rachel, could you walk us through a little bit on the history of plywood in the United States? Obviously, something that, as many of these technologies, was, you know, invented in Europe, but then kind of really strongly implemented in the United States extensively. And for this, we have gone to the dastardly source, trade publications and websites from the industry itself, because they like to brag about their history on these things, which can be an interesting and useful resource. So, Rachel, could you talk to us a little bit about plywood?
Yeah. So we, as you said, we found kind of a corporate history on the American Plywood Association website, apawood.org. So the first patent for what could be called plywood was issued December 26, 1865, to John K. Mayo of New York City. A reissue of that patent, dated August 18, 1868, described Mayo's development as follows. The invention consists in cementing or otherwise fastening together a number of these scales of sheets, with the grain of the successive pieces, or some of them, running crosswise or diversely from that of the others. So Mayo had the vision and patented it, but he didn't really capitalize on it. The website said apparently he had not much business sense, since history does not record that he ever capitalized on his patents. So they kind of dunked on him a little bit. So kind of fast forwarding to 1905, the city of Portland, Oregon, was getting ready to host a World's Fair as part of the 100th anniversary celebration of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Several local businesses were asked to prepare exhibits for the event, including Portland Manufacturing Company, a small wooden box factory in the St. John's district of the city. Part owner and plant manager Gustav Carlson decided to laminate wood panels from a variety of Pacific Northwest softwoods. Using paintbrushes as glue spreaders and house jacks as presses, several panels were laid up for display. Called three-ply veneer work, the product created considerable interest among fairgoers, including several door, cabinet, and trunk manufacturers who then placed orders. By 1907, Portland Manufacturing had installed an automatic glue spreader and a sectional hand press. Production soared to 420 panels a day, and an industry was born. So plywood was mainly used in the beginning for car doors, especially. So doors were a very popular usage for plywood in the beginning. And also, I wanted to touch on another Pacific Northwest company, Weyerhaeuser. This is a huge company in Washington and also Idaho. And it was founded in January 1900 when Frederick Weyerhaeuser and partners bought 900,000 acres of Washington forest land from Northern Pacific Railway. So we've kind of talked about the railways before. They weren't so much making money off of their railroads, which they did, but also from owning massive amounts of land. So they were able to sell this land, 900,000 acres, which was the largest private land sale at that time. So Frederick Weyerhaeuser started his company in Washington, and kind of fast forwarding to 1917, we already kind of touched on World War I. The Army used troops to actually work in Weyerhaeuser's forests to increase lumber production for the war. And then in 1921, the Wood Conversion Company was formed to research and market new uses for wood. Among these were balsam wool, which is a fluffy material used as insulation, and new wood, which was a composite insulation board. And so the wood conversion company over the next 30 years would also introduce dozens of new products. In 1928, Frederick Weyerhaeuser, the founder, gave a rousing talk to the company's sales force, emphasizing the tradition of, quote, square dealing. This inspired one of the greatest marketing efforts ever attempted at Weyerhaeuser. Take this with a grain of salt. This is coming from their company history, and they're obviously being very self-aggrandizing. So one of the greatest marketing efforts ever attempted at Weyerhaeuser was Four Square Lumber, registered trademark. So for the first time, lumber was grade marked, precisely squared, cut to exact length, and wrapped. So the fact that it took all the way to 1928 to kind of reach the standardization of wood lengths and wood grades kind of shows how much innovation was going on at this time. But there was still some ways to go for it to take like 60 years for lumber to be graded and kind of industrialized in this way.
Yeah, I think one of the themes that we have talked about in passing and will be increasingly talking about, especially as we get into more first industrial revolution topics on this show, is this idea that some of the industries do lag behind the sort of industrial development and the trends that we've talked about relative to other industries. And usually you can look pretty materially and see the factors for that, right? Like if it's an industry that requires a particularly high level of skill and precision, you're going to have to first be able to figure out the, you know, kind of machinery and machine tooling to be able to transfer that to a mechanized process. Similarly, if you have something that requires relatively little capital investment and you have a very large labor pool available and qualified to do the job, then in many cases you can delay your sort of industrialization and standardization. Another huge factor that can never be overemphasized in American history is this issue of free real estate, so to speak. We haven't really talked on this episode about native displacement and the role that that plays in the timber industry, or that the timber industry played in that, because that would probably be a little bit further beyond the scope of what we're talking about on this bonus episode, and we'd have to do a much more sort of expansive view of that, covering various eras and geographical areas of the United States. But suffice it to say that the quote-unquote free real estate, generally often dispossessed from the indigenous nations and then handed over to railroads for basically free, so then they could sell off these huge tracts of it, like we saw with Weyerhaeuser and Northern Pacific Railway, to then finance the construction of these railways. Until you start to quote-unquote run out of the land and the timber, there's very little incentive for these companies to start getting really efficient about it. Again, when we're talking about the Forest Products Laboratory and their work, not even starting until 1910, of saying, hey, what if we put preservatives on railroad ties so they don't have to be replaced every 5 seconds because bugs and things are eating them, or they're rotting away in the weather conditions? Or what about even just the one about the actual amount of wood being yielded, the average lumber yield per log rising from 25% to 60% through their research. Historically, especially if you're talking about like Maine and Canada in, you know, the 17th and 18th centuries and so forth, you'd knock down the tree and just kind of give it a real whack along the sides to knock off the curvy round parts, and then whatever squared off part you were left with, you would stack into your ship because it was safer to stack squared off lumber than rollable lumber that could shift suddenly in your cargo hold. And you would think, well, okay, then you can still use the rest of that scrap wood for other stuff. But in many cases, no, they just left it there. They were like, well, we don't need this. So in many cases, this was a relatively low capital industry. You know, often make the guys bring their own axes and saws to cut things down. You'd have a sawmill here and there to do some of that cutting work to get it ready for shipment and so forth. But for the most part, relative to a lot of other sort of manufacturing industries and so forth, you had all of the incentives working against going toward machinery instead of people, against being efficient with your resources, and against just sort of using up all of the land and trees as fast as possible. And so at this point, when you start to say, okay, the frontier is closed, we've linked up the railroads across the various parts of the United States at different points, and we can now, you know, not only access these northwestern timber stands much more easily than before, but also we're starting to run low on supplies in earlier areas we'd been harvesting in the plains states, in the, you know, the upper Midwest, the Great Lakes region, and certainly, you know, they had moved on at that point. Obviously, not everyone had, but like as a whole, the industry had shifted away from places like Maine and Canada in terms, in relative terms. Although obviously, those areas remain significant timber production sites even to present day, especially for things like paper for wood pulp. And this is not, we're not even really getting into on this episode the different kinds of trees and what they're used for. Rachel just alluded to this issue about, you know, softwoods, and that, you know, there we could talk about hardwoods and stuff if we had more time. But basically what we're looking at here is this sort of very late in the game shift relative to these other industries, in, you know, later in the second industrial revolution, of saying, okay, now we need to get serious about using this wood more efficiently, figuring out how to get more money out of it. You're always going to be able to get more money out of a mass-produced manufactured good made of wood than by just selling, you know, raw timber with no other changes or manufacturing processes and so forth. The finished goods are always going to be more valuable. So that's why we sort of see this shift, and that's why we see it kind of happening later on. I want to talk now a little bit about prefabricated frontier housing and post-frontier housing and wooden materials. Now, it's important to note what we're actually talking about. While it's commonly referred to as prefabricated homes, it's not technically prefabricated, because we're talking about homes that were assembled on site out of various wood materials, as opposed to, like, today, a prefabricated home, which I think, Rachel, is the case for your house. You would, like, bring that in on a flatbed or something. It's already all put together, right?
Yeah, that's correct. They're also commonly known as, like, manufactured homes. And there's actually a couple of manufactured home building sites in the area. So it's pretty interesting. It seems to be a pretty booming business still.
Yeah, so the forerunner to this, though, were these ones that were built on site out of these interchangeable parts and materials generally made out of wood. And so for this, we're going to turn to a very interesting history article on the National Park Service website. And this was written because they had done a grant related to some historic preservation around this. So houses have been built in one place and reassembled in another throughout history. Possibly the first advertised prefabricated home was the Manning Portable Cottage, conceived in 1830 by a London carpenter, H. John Manning. This house was built in components, then shipped and assembled by British emigrants. Prefabricated homes were produced during the gold rush in the United States as well during the 19th century to enable California prospectors to quickly erect homes. Also known as kit houses, pre-cut houses, ready-cut houses, mail-order homes, or catalog homes, they remained popular into the first half of the 20th century. Kit house manufacturers sold houses in many different plans and styles, ranging from simple bungalows to imposing colonials. For a fixed price, manufacturers supplied the materials needed for construction of a particular house, with the exclusion of brick, concrete, and masonry, such as would be needed for laying a foundation, which the customer would have to arrange to have done locally. Now, these were, you know, as they just alluded to, used in things like the gold rush or for homesteading settlers on the prairie states and so forth. But these were after the sort of frontier period, and you get the sort of rise of proto-suburbanization and so forth. These are eventually popularized most recognizably as Sears Modern Homes. So, Rachel, could you talk a little bit about Sears Modern Homes as an example of one of these sort of manufactured forest products?
Yeah. So Sears Modern Homes were sold from 1908 through 1942, although production of the kits actually stopped in 1940, and the Sears Modern Home catalog was also discontinued in 1940. So oddly enough, Sears Modern Homes were still advertised through May 1942, so they were probably just getting rid of existing stock until that time. So in 1906, Frank W. Cushel, a Sears manager, was given responsibility for the catalog company's unwieldy, unprofitable building materials department. Sales were down, and there was excess inventory languishing in warehouses. He is credited with suggesting to Richard Sears that the company assemble kits of all the parts needed and sell entire houses through mail order. In the same year, the Aladdin Company of Bay City, Michigan, offered for sale the first kit homes through mail order. In 1908, Sears issued its first specialty catalog for houses, Book of Modern Homes and Building Plans, featuring 44 house styles ranging in price from $360 to $2,890. The first mail order for a Sears house was filled in 1908. As Sears mail order catalogs were in millions of homes, Sears had a distinct advantage over many of its competitors, as it was able to promote its modern homes plans to large numbers of prospective customers through its general merchandise catalog. And from that National Park Service article that we mentioned earlier, one American company heavily invested in the kit house concept was Sears Roebuck & Company. Sears catalog homes were ready to assemble kit houses sold through mail order by Sears, and more than 370 designs of Sears homes were offered during the program's 32-year history. So they really expanded over the years. And some of those houses were really impressive. On the Wikipedia article for Sears Modern Homes, there's a model called the Magnolia, and it's a pretty sizable two-story colonial-style house that is actually pretty impressive for a DIY kit house.
Now, Rachel, I know that before we bring this episode to a close and sort of discuss some of the big picture themes, I know you wanted to touch on another local aspect from the Pacific Northwest and specifically Idaho and the timber industry there during the Second Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, so I found the Idaho Forest Products Commission website, which is kind of a public-private partnership that exists at the grace of the state government. They did include an early history of Idaho's forests, starting with the territorial days. So early laws regulated the use of lumber in the Idaho territory, so people could use trees for home and farm use, and one person could buy as much as 160 acres of forest land. However, large lumber companies were not allowed to cut Idaho timber until 1892, after it became a state. So even when the railroads came through Idaho, they could not cut Idaho's trees. So wooden ties for the tracks came from as far away as the Black Hills of South Dakota. So in 1890, Idaho achieved statehood, and then lumbermen from the Great Lakes country began buying Idaho forest land. At least one company had a mill at Coeur d'Alene as early as 1890, though it was against the law until 1892. So this was pretty good timing for the lumber industry. This was about the time the forests of the Great Plains were being depleted, and before the laboratory came along to improve efficiency of lumber use. And industry was looking to the West for lumber and other forest products. And a note on the Idaho Forest Products Commission, it was created in 1992 by an act of the Idaho legislature. The purpose of the commission is to, quote, promote the economic and environmental welfare of the state by providing a means for the collection and dissemination of information regarding the management of the state's public and private forest lands and the forest products industry. So activities of the commission are funded by mandatory assessments paid solely by the forest industry. The actual rates are set each year by commission members based on the programs they want to carry out. So their goals are to increase public understanding that Idaho's forests are a renewable source of important consumer products and environmental values, to provide, coordinate, and disseminate factual information about economic and environmental aspects of timber management practices, to promote public support for Idaho's forest products industry, to help achieve and maintain a healthy forest products industry through responsible forest stewardship, and to advocate balanced use of forest resources. So Idaho has a huge amount of public lands as well as private lands. So I think there's often a misunderstanding of public land use. And so I think this commission kind of helps to clear up some misconceptions about public land use and how the forest industry is allowed to work in Idaho.
So Rachel, big thematic takeaways. I've obviously, I think, given mine over the course of the episode, but I was wondering what your thoughts were in terms of the rise of the forest products research and development sector?
Well, like you said, I think it was just really easy to just kind of go through the forests and decimate them in the early days of the country. But once we started depleting those like Midwest and Eastern forests, we kind of had to really look at how we were using forest products and really improve our processes. Like you said, with the railroad ties, just learning to use preservatives so they weren't getting eaten and needed to be replaced every year or whatever. It's really interesting how much later this innovation happened compared to some of the other material resources we've talked about in past episodes. But like you said, it basically was free real estate and free resources for a long time, which probably delayed that need to innovate.
And they were absolutely willing to just throw human bodies into the machine, literally into the buzzsaw in some cases. One of the things that inspired me to do this episode was that I read the very, very long novel about, I guess, the timber industry, as well as just life in the United States and Canada and so forth, Bark Skins, which there's a TV adaptation that I don't really recommend and also doesn't really have much to do with the book. I mean, it's sort of nominally based on like the first couple chapters, but this book is by the author who did Brokeback Mountain. But anyway, this is a very long novel. Eventually, the Forest Products Laboratory, I think, is mentioned, as well as prefabricated kit homes and so forth. But just this willingness to just absolutely sacrifice people's life and limbs or both to this monstrous expropriation of and destruction of natural resources across an entire continent is very thought-provoking and inspired me to do some more research into the actual history of this particular element of it. And as we said, this rather late industrialization process for this particular industry. All right, Rachel, thanks so much for coming on this week to talk about the forest products in the United States.
Yeah, it was a really interesting topic to get into.